It's my pleasure to welcome you here to the Car Coward Show, where our mission is to serve you with advice and information that empowers you to make better financial decisions in your life. And if you haven't already subscribed to one of our newsletters, what are you waiting for? Because they are awesome and free. Just go to clark.com/newsletters, and you're going to be able to follow late-breaking, solid consumer advice you can act on, as well as, with our Clark Deals newsletter, the greatest legit bargains of the day. So today I'm going to talk about something that has been coming into us in our Team Clark Consumer Action Center and has been much in the news and on television and various forms of media about squatters stealing people's homes. And this is bad, ugly stuff that I want to talk about. I want to talk about how much you need to worry and why this is just out of nowhere become such a problem. Also, I love playing the credit card reward game, but when is it worth it? When is it not? And is it appropriate for you in your situation? We're going to talk that through. So one of the situations we had recently come in to the Team Clark Consumer Action Center, if you're not aware of what that is, it's where you can get one-on-one advice and information and guidance 30 hours each week for free from our team members, both paid and volunteers. And just 2 weeks ago, we had our latest installment of somebody losing their own home to squatters. And this is something that has lots of wrinkles to it, but it's become a thing. There are people on TikTok and other social media posting how easy it is and how great it is for you to just be able to help yourself to somebody else's home. One of the people who contacted us recently had gone on a one-week vacation and came home, and there were people living in his home who changed the locks. And the police said, well, nothing we can do about this. And this is happening in various states around the country. The biggest problems of all happening in Georgia and Texas, where the laws are really essentially silent. If I go into your house, break into your house, and steal something from your house, let's say I go in and help myself to your TV, and I'm walking out with your TV, I have committed a criminal act. If I'm arrested and charged, you know, I did the crime, I have to do the time, right? How about instead, and this is a problem state after state after state, if I go into your house, move in, help myself to the food in your refrigerator, watch that TV, sleep in your bed, whatever, in so many states around the country, I have not committed a crime. It is considered to be a civil problem. The owner of the house has to go to court and try to get you evicted from the home. That could take months, as has happened with these ugly celebrated cases around the country. You know, there was the one in California with Airbnb. I'm going to talk about that in a second, where somebody moved into an Airbnb for a three-day stay and stayed, I think, 2 years. And this is so in the news of the weird. Couple of things. One, it's not like this is going to happen to all of us. It's not even going to happen to a meaningful percent of us. But when it happens to you and you have worked hard to buy this home and suddenly you can't live in your own home because somebody else invited themselves in and is living in that home, this is just absolutely atrocious. There are a number of angles to this. One, we get so many questions about where somebody commits fraud, pretends to be you, and they look for homes that are owned free and clear, and they are able to convince the local government, convince lenders that they're the rightful owner of the house instead of you, and they take ownership of the home. They borrow money against the home. And that has many different layers where someone's just trying to commit financial fraud and grab money against a paid off home, or they want to go further and they want to steal the home. The second case we had in the last couple of weeks, the one 2 weeks ago, was one where someone did that. They committed fraud and they took out debt against the home and they took control of the home. And the people who had owned the home, all the police would do is evict the actual real homeowners because the paperwork said that the crook was the proper owner of the home. I mean, we have an ugly, ugly mess here. Most of the time, this occurs with vacant homes, and particularly a situation where maybe an aging relative has gone into assisted living or they have passed away and the home's just sitting there unloved. That's the most common circumstance where a home is stolen. And I want you to know, if you are the adult children of an aging parent who goes into assisted living or who does pass away, and you now have the responsibility of the house, you want to get that house occupied. You don't want it sitting vacant because you're creating the possibility of a squatter taking possession when that house is sitting empty. Believe it or not, there are people who are watching the obits, and then they're trying to figure out if there's a house owned there that is sitting empty that they can help themselves to. Having the property loved and rented out, at least in the interim, is a really wise thing. Having cameras on location to make sure nothing crazy is going on there is a great idea with any vacant home. The Airbnb angle is definitely news of the weird. So weird that there's now even an obscure insurance policy you can buy for loss of income while you're trying to get a squatter out of your Airbnb. I mean, this has so many layers. And Krista, you and I have talked about this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the big problem here, the wide open opportunity, is the laws in state after state are not explicitly written to make it a crime to move into somebody's house and help yourself to it.
Yeah. And people are also like on TikTok exploiting this, telling people how to do it. It's really spreading like wildfire. It's crazy.
So the Daily Mail compiled states this is happening in, and I mentioned Georgia and Texas are the two most common.
Yeah, and California.
It's happened in California, New York, Florida, trying to remember where else. And vacation-oriented properties or seasonal properties are very much at risk because people get kind of a sense of, oh, those people don't live here for months each year.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just go in and help themselves to your place. Again, cameras useful and helpful. Something we're doing at Clark.com is we're putting up a briefing about this. And in the states that are affected, if you live in them, you need to contact your elected representative, your state legislator, your state senator, your assembly person, whatever it's called in your state, and tell them you want anti-squatter statute passed. I guess this is one of those things that didn't really occur to people.
Yeah,
we went through a squatting era. I think it was in the late 1800s that squatting was really in the United States. And suddenly it's in again,
yeah.
And the laws are behind on this. It's something that is not a major piece of legislation. It's not a controversial piece of legislation. It just needs to become it. One of the things we've learned in the ones that we've been involved in with our Team Clark Consumer Action Center is the laws, because they're silent, basically operate where they are to the benefit of the squatter, not the homeowner. And again, we've got a lot of things we have to worry about in life. This is not one people should
right.
be worrying about.
But this is one we feel like needs action taken. Like, we want everyone to try to take action on this. So we do have a sample letter on Clark.com that you can send to your state representative, whatever it ends up being, if you want to. And we really hope that people will do this and look into this because it's crazy.
It is. This is absolutely crazy. And because there's no lobbyists behind fixing it, truth is, legislative members, really, their ears are attuned to what lobbyists are asking for. So this is a case where constituents have to rise up and make noise, and then it becomes a priority. And this will be fixed. It's just the people who suffer in the meantime, that's what's not okay.
So if you want to see that letter and you want to take action, go to clark.com/squatters. Clark.com/squatters. That's a shortcut we made to that. We'll go to questions now. Tracy in Florida says, I've heard you recommend only purchasing term life insurance to use to replace income while you're working. We are working on our retirement plans, and I was reading about the impacts when one spouse passes before the other, such as reduced income because of only one Social Security check, possible reduced pension payments, and also now being taxed at single rates and getting only single deductions, while not necessarily decreasing living expenses. Do you have any recommendations for life insurance or other products to help protect against this scenario? As longtime listeners of your show, we've learned to be big savers and have maxed out 401k, HSA, and Roth IRA for years and are now looking to retire in the next year or two using the rule of 55. Thank you for all your advice and guidance to help us get to the point of FIRE.
Well, Tracy, fantastic that you have been such a max saver. So you answered the question by that. If you have gotten to a point in your life that you've saved enough money in various tax advantage or tax-free accounts like 401ks, the HSA, which is the greatest savings vehicle that exists in the United States, and Roth IRA, you have really reduced the impact that a reduction in a Social Security check actually represents in terms of income in retirement years. Because you're completely right. When I talk about buying term life insurance as a source of replacement of income during someone's key working years, it ignores the question that you raised, which is when one of the members of a couple passes away, a lot of expenses remain the same. Taxes could potentially go up when you're one instead of two. And you got this smaller check coming in from Social Security. So you counteract it either if you don't have all the great history you do with saving money in different accounts that becomes the lion's share of what you live on. And, oh, you mentioned the pension. A pension can be, depending on the election you take with a pension, it can continue 100% in most cases for the life of both members of a couple. So one passes away, pension stays the same. Most commonly, people select 50%, that it goes 100% when both are living, 50% when the named recipient of the pension passes away. And then others, it goes to zero. My thing, I did 100%. So my wife is covered the same as we are now. When I pass away, she'll still get the same pension benefit. So it's all how you cover it. With insurance, the only way you can cover it usually is to buy what's known as permanent insurance or whole life that stays in place to age 100. A much, much, much more expensive product than buying a level term insurance policy. Those are really designed to last through the end of your working years, where the whole life goes all the way to age 100. So that would be an alternative. But in your case, you've already done the real hard work with additional money put aside in various accounts. If you look at receiving, let's say, half a Social Security check instead of a full one, your surviving spouse should still be okay.
Speaking of checks, Michael in Ohio wrote in and says, Clark often talks about the dangers of personal checks, especially sending them through the mail. But at one of his favorite children, Vanguard, if I want to make a qualified charitable distribution as part of my required minimum distribution.
Should I explain what any of that means?
It's okay. The only way they will do it is to make out a check to the qualified charity, then mail it to me. Then I have to mail it to the charity. Are these checks safer than my personal checks?
Completely safer than your personal checks, because who's at risk in this case is Vanguard, not you. It's going to be their transit numbers on that check, not yours. And there should be a more modern way to do this for your donation to a charity. But Vanguard chooses to send a paper check. I had this. I have a Vanguard Charitable, which was a donor advised fund. And I gave money to a charity that the check was lost or stolen in the mail. And it was a lot of paperwork to get that check replaced. And it went fine the second time. But checks are really risky. In this case, the risk, though, is borne by Vanguard. And if they want to act like it's 1965, they can act like it's 1965. Because, again, you're not bearing the risk of them doing it an antiquated way. Coming up ahead, I want to talk about the modern way we pay for things is credit cards, electronic payments, all that. A lot of people are following the siren song of a particular type of credit card that maybe for you it would be best to ignore.
When it comes to your finances, go for the credit card that's always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We're talking real service from real people, whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
All right, this one was mind-blowing to me. It says a lot about consumer behavior. So Bankrate did a survey of about 1,750 credit card users and found that 2/3 of those carrying balances on credit cards were using reward credit cards. Okay, so why is that something that I would be upset about? Because reward cards tend to carry the highest interest rates of any credit cards. So if you have a card that's even giving you back 2% in some kind of rewards, cash back, points, miles, hotel stays, whatever the ratio is for whatever the prize is at the end of the day, that is fool's gold because of what you're paying in interest every month on the card. Now, why did I say this consumer behavior? Okay, when people are surveyed about credit cards, their assumption in their own life is they're going to charge on it and then they're going to pay the balance in full. That's what we think we're going to do. But unfortunately, a majority of us don't pay the bill in full. We're getting no grace period. We're paying big interest on the cards. And today, when I say big interest, I mean big interest. You know, money you shop around for to put in savings, you shop around, you're going to earn maybe 4 or 5%. On a credit card, though, usual bank credit card, you're looking 20% more or less on an interest rate. And reward cards, more. It's not at all unusual for a reward card to have an interest rate of 25%. On the other hand, as I shared with you about 6 weeks ago, there are credit cards out there. They're not like steals of deals, but there are a lot of credit cards out there with interest rates right around 10%. So if you're getting a 2% reward on your charging, but you're paying twice the interest, you're not getting anywhere. You're going backwards. And so if you are a net payer is somebody who, when the bill comes in, you pay the bill. Reward cards can be fantastic because the interest rate doesn't matter. And the truth, those of us like me, and if it's you as well, if you're a net payer, you're paying your balances in full, we're being subsidized by the people that are paying 20 or so percent interest on cards. We're getting those rewards because the merchants are paying rip-off fees, taking the credit card in the first place. And then the consumer who's paying 20% interest, let me tell you, nobody ever got rich paying 20% interest to Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or Discover. So this requires a mental reset. If you, with the best of intentions, you expect you're going to pay balances in full, but that's not what's happening in your life. What I'd like you to do is I want you to shop for a new credit card. And the best place to start and probably even finish the search is with a credit union you may drive by every day and never notice. Because credit unions being owned by their members, their business model is to serve their members. And so that's why the interest rate on a credit union credit card is normally going to be half what it is from a bank, because the bank is using it as a giant profit center. The credit union, remember, they're just trying to cover write-offs and things like that and run that credit card operation at what's ultimately break even. That's what a credit union is supposed to be about, because the benefits are to flow to you as an account holder who is a member. And then there are some banks that offer good rates as well on credit cards. So forget the rewards if you're running balances, or get to where you don't run balances and then the rewards are useful. It's one of those areas where it's a guilty pleasure, because I'm benefiting in a way that I'm getting the rewards off of other people's expenses, the merchants and the other customers who run balances. That's the way the game works. That's why the reward thing is so rewarding for the right person and so unrewarding for two-thirds. Think about that. Two-thirds of people with balances are using these reward cards. Uh-uh. Don't do it anymore. Don't make the bank rich.
We'll go to questions. Lee in Maine wrote in saying, when booking a hotel on Priceline, I accidentally booked the wrong hotel in a neighboring town. I noticed my mistake immediately after clicking and called Priceline. They would not refund my $450 and the hotel won't either, even though I did book at the correct hotel in the same chain immediately after making the mistake. Any ideas on how to get a refund?
Lee, you did the right things by contacting people right away. And I find that with Priceline, it's owned by a company called Booking.com, that Priceline, it's all about pushing the right buttons. If you just called customer no service at Priceline, you're not going to get anywhere. If you called the hotel, even if you called it direct and you just talked to whoever was on duty at that time, you're not going to get any movement on it, because the written policies are clear. But at the same time, they do bend them in a situation that's obviously clearly clerical. I want you to do a couple of things. I want you to write in a Better Business Bureau complaint about what happened with Priceline and say that you realized your error immediately, you booked another hotel immediately, and you would like at least a credit towards a future stay. At the same time, the hotel involved, you want to go online, figure out who the general manager is of that location and see if you can get an accommodation from the general manager of that hotel. One or the other will often work, because it's all about getting to the individual with the authority to make an accommodation to you. And with Priceline and with any hotel booking, actually, double and triple check your work. I remember once I messed this up in Northern California. There were no potential accommodations at that point. I had to eat that. It was a very expensive lesson learned. And so don't be distracted at all. Don't be a multitasker. Just be 100% focused on what you're doing right at that moment. But when the mistake happens, remember, they still got money from you at Priceline, and it was immediate. It really is beyond unacceptable that they would not make any accommodation for you. But again, it's getting to the right people there. And let's see if you don't get some results through a Better Business Bureau post. And you say, hey, I made the initial mistake. Here's what happened. I immediately noticed, got no help. Could I please have an accommodation? That's how you do the Better Business Bureau complaint. And then with the hotel, direct to that general manager. And you will be able to figure out who that is if you hunt around online or even call the front desk and say, I want to know if you could tell me who the general manager is. I'd like to give him a compliment about an employee or something like that. And they'll say, oh, yeah, blah, blah, blah. You'll have the information.
Deborah in Alabama says, I recently saw an email from my credit card company offering a $300 bonus if I sign up for a specific checking account and have $1,500 in deposits in the initial 90 days and set up a qualified deposit from payroll. What are your thoughts on this? And is it hard to get these bonuses or meet the requirements? I don't want to do a lot of work for nothing.
Okay, so Deborah, why do they have the requirement specifically direct deposit, payroll and all that? Because they figure we're creatures of habit. Once we set it up, we don't unset it up. As long as you're willing to jump through the hoops, pick up your $300 from them, and then change back to the direct deposit wherever it was after you got the money and all that, great. Go for it and get the money. We had somebody who posted, I think it was on Clark Stinks, about me talking about the creature of habit problem and people intend to do something but don't. And that person posted all the different promotions like this that they'd taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. And they had made thousands of dollars signing up for these various things. So if you are really, really good at follow-up, go for it.
Vincent in North Carolina says, I have a follow-up question to your recent podcast segment about the car market swinging back toward consumers. In recent weeks, you've mentioned deals on EVs and certain often high-end brands. In your opinion, where are the best deals in the minivan market? We'd love to get an Odyssey or comparable van for our growing family, but the longevity and popularity of minivans means we're not seeing a lot of bargains out there, especially for in-demand brands like Honda and Toyota. I've not seen any used vans that look like a deal. Either they were high enough trim package to be substantially more than a new base model, or very high mileage for only a few thousand dollars less than a new vehicle. Do you anticipate things will be better in a year or two? We always pay cash for cars, and it's hard to convince ourselves to plop down $40,000 on a vehicle with our first house purchase coming up soon as well. But $30,000 or more for a high mileage vehicle doesn't seem like a good value.
Yeah, I mean, this is the bind that a lot of growing families face, is the minivan market is almost like its own orbit. It's a specialized market dominated by the Honda Odyssey and the Toyota Sienna. And the cost of these is just crazy. There is a third player, the Kia Carnival. They are cheaper brand new than the Odysseys and the Siennas. The Siennas are the most in demand right now and cost the most. You will find a better deal on a used Carnival than you would on a used Odyssey or Sienna. But this is such a market that's so odd, because people will buy one of these, and these are people haulers, and they may keep it for a long, 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 long time. So the normal supply of used vehicles doesn't exist for minivans, because people buy one and they keep it. So they end up being a very expensive upfront purchase, new or used, but people do keep them long enough that if you look at the effective cost per year, they end up being usually a more affordable purchase than other vehicles, just because people do own them for such a long period. It's not at all unusual to own one more than a decade. Krista, when you have a Sienna or an Odyssey? You
had an Odyssey. That thing
and
was
how
a
how long
workhorse.
Did you have it? 15 years?
Somewhere around there, 14 maybe. Yeah, it was great. The best. When you have a family like that, it is a workhorse.
I mean, it really is one of those things. And our Odyssey was a 2014. And now my oldest daughter has that Odyssey. It's still going strong. And we got it 2014 and 2013. So it's 11 years old. And it looks trash because it's been through two generations of kids at this point, but it's still running just fine. And that's the problem in the minivan market.
The woman who bought my Odyssey, I actually know this because she's a friend of someone who works in the Team Clark Consumer Action Center. She uses it as an Uber. She hauls around her family and she Ubers part-time. So,
I mean, it's for specific market forces that you find them so expensive, but look at those three, maybe you'll find that bargain somewhere. Now, you said something I can't let just fly by. And that's about how you're going to buy a home coming up soon. If you take out a loan on that van, it's going to hurt you when you're trying to qualify for the loan for your home. And that's just a fact. You want to avoid any borrowing of any kind in the 6 months leading up to a home purchase.
Hopefully they're not, because they said they always pay cash, but yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I hope that I gave you something you could use to go out and shop the market, because it is a hard market. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Remember what we're about, you learning ways to save more, spend less, and avoid getting ripped off.